This is KMXT Kodiak 100.1 FM. We're also in HD and streaming live on the web at kmxt.org. Today on the noon news, a deadline for a relief program, Raven, Alaska adds another destination hub, the latest musical project by Nicholas Galanin to be released in April, evacuation in Juneau due to an avalanche potential, and Anchorage mayoral candidates offer competing visions on pandemic recovery. And it is 37 degrees in Kodiak currently, west winds at 7 miles per hour. Today, scattered snow showers afternoon, mostly sunny with a high near 37 degrees, northwest winds around 5 miles per hour, and a 40% chance of precipitation.
I'm Windsor Johnston. FBI Director Christopher Wray is calling the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building an act of domestic terrorism. Wray testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee today as Congress continues to examine the events leading up to the violent attack. NPR's Brian Naylor reports Wray also told lawmakers that tolerating the rioters' actions would make a mockery of the nation's rule of law.
Testifying for the first time since the attack, Director Wray said he was appalled by the violence and destruction of that day.
That attack, that siege, was criminal behavior, plain and simple, and it's behavior that we, the FBI, view as domestic terrorism.
In Wray's words, quite a number of the some 280 people who have been arrested on charges relating to the attack had militia or white supremacist connections. And to date, he said there's no evidence that anyone connected to Antifa had been involved. Wray said that domestic terrorism was metastasizing across the country, and he defended the Bureau's sharing of intelligence in the days leading up to the attack, but conceded what happened on January 6th was not an acceptable result. Brian Naylor, NPR News.
President Biden is invoking the Defense Production Act to create a partnership between two vaccine makers. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, Merck will begin producing the COVID-19 vaccine developed by Johnson & Johnson.
Johnson & Johnson, whose vaccine was given emergency use authorization this past weekend, has experienced production delays. With this agreement, Merck would retool two of its facilities to begin making the one-shot J&J vaccine. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
These obviously are two companies that have historically been competitors, so the fact that they are coming together speaks to the ability of this administration broadly to bring them to the table and work together to address the pandemic in the country.
The Defense Production Act is being used to free up vaccine ingredients and help Merck get set up to make the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Psaki also said the Defense Department will provide daily logistical support to strengthen Johnson & Johnson's efforts. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The Biden administration is imposing sanctions on seven Russian officials for the poisoning and jailing of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says the U.S. is joining the European Union as part of a multilateral effort to punish the Kremlin.
The use of any chemical weapon directly violates international legal obligations and norms of civilized conduct.
The Kremlin has denied any wrongdoing. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 144 points, the S&P down 31. This is NPR News in Washington.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
And you're listening to KMXT's Midday News Report. Friday is the deadline for a relief program that could pay up to a year's worth of rent and utilities for renters impacted by the pandemic. As KUAC's Robin reports, the state received more than $200 million to prevent folks from being evicted.
The money came from the coronavirus relief bill Congress passed last December, which included at least $200 million for rent relief for Alaskans. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, or AHFC, is taking applications at their website, alaskahousingrelief.org, until this Friday at midnight. Stacy Barnes works for the AHFC and says if renters are struggling to pay rent or utilities, or they owe past rent, or are worried about eviction, this money is for them. It's specifically for lower-income households financially impacted by COVID-19.
In the Fairbanks area, the maximum income that a household can make is $74,480 post the COVID event. So, you know, a year ago, they could have been making much more than that, but as a result of, they may now qualify for this program.
That income limit is a little bit less in Delta and Tok and a little bit more in Healy and Denali Park.
You know, that eligibility checker that we have on the website will also help people. You don't have to know off the top of your head how much money you made last year. The website is designed to make that as easy as possible.
More than 21,000 Alaskans have beat the Friday deadline so far, many of them applying on their smartphones. Barnes says a lot of Alaskans applied for renter relief in a separate program last year that was able to give renters 2 months' worth of money. And those people can apply for this program as well.
And our commitment to Alaskans is that we're taking care of arrearages first. If you're behind on your rent, that's something that we're going to be able to pay your landlord on your behalf up to a total of 12 months.
The AlaskaHousingRelief.org application is also for folks in overcrowded homes where someone has moved in together because of the pandemic, or unsafe situations where there might be domestic violence.
If we can just encourage them to visit the website to check their eligibility, who knows what might happen that's good in their life as a result of stability in their housing situation.
But it is not for landlords. Barnes says there is some AHFC help for property owners, and there may be more soon.
We're not at a point where we're able to provide mortgage relief, but we know that that's part of the national conversation that's occurring.
Over the weekend, the U.S. House passed another $1.9 trillion relief package. That bill is now in front of the U.S. Senate. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Raven, Alaska is adding another YK Delta hub to its list of destinations. The airline will begin flying to St. Mary's on the Lower Yukon River in a few weeks. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur has more.
The exact date is not yet set, but Raven's first flight to St. Mary's is targeted for March. Raven CEO Rob McKinney says flights to St. Mary's will route from Anchorage through Aniak to St. Mary's and back to Anchorage.
In the beginning, it'll probably be two a week, and then we're hoping to flex up to five or six a week in St. Mary's as the summer draws near.
Raven resumed flights to Aniak at the end of February, making it the airline's 11th destination and the first YK Delta community where Raven has returned service. Last year, the company went through bankruptcy and has since entered new ownership. Though Raven is returning flights to the region, it is not yet returning jobs. Raven sold most of its assets as part of the bankruptcy, including its facilities in Aniak and St. Mary's. Ryanair bought those facilities and will be handling Raven's on-the-ground flight operations in those communities. McKinney says the company could add jobs as the airline expands in the region. The former Raven that went bankrupt had built a reputation of unreliable service and numerous plane crashes, some of them fatal. New CEO McKinney says he and his partner are working to build a company that customers can trust.
The Raven that you see now, although it's the same name and the same logos, is a far different company than what it was before.
All employees have undergone customer service training. Pilots underwent flight training. The airline is limiting seats to prevent bags being bumped. The staff meets weekly about safety, and this new Raven is smaller and more specialized. The Raven of before was an overarching brand encompassing five different air carriers under different managements flying different types of planes.
Today's Raven has one type of airplane and one air carrier certificate and one seamless management.
that one type of plane is a Dash 8. Another difference is that whereas the Raven of before flew to most YK Delta communities, the new Raven will likely only fly to the larger hubs.
You're never going to see the Raven of before where they were trying to go into every community and do so many different kinds of flying, because I think that that just spreads focus too thin.
The airline is honoring unused tickets purchased before the bankruptcy, but not frequent flyer miles. McKinney says the new Raven was not given access to the old Raven system for tracking those miles. One thing will stay the same with this new Raven airline. Customers will still get a complimentary cookie on flights. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
A new musical project led by Nicholas Gallinan has signed with legendary Sub Pop Records. KNBA's Trip Krause talks with Gallinan and bandmate Zach Wass about their latest album.
Close the Distance is the first single off the debut album for Yahtzeen, the latest project from Otis Calvin III, Zach D. Wass, and y'all Yahtzeen, Nicholas Gallinan. Yahtzeen is a nod to Glennon's name.
The Tlingit title, Yahtzeen, which is be alive, translation. For me, using Tlingit language and language is always something that's really important. It's such a core of our ways of being and thinking, and so always trying to implement or engage it with language when I can, even though I'm not. You know, I'm not a speaker of the language, but I'm always a student.
Gallinan, who's Tlingit and Anunga, also works as a carver, engraver, and visual artist. He's based in Sitka, Alaska. Like Gallinan, musician and guitarist Wass also lives and works in Sitka. Wass works summers commercial fishing with his father and works on music and projects in the off season.
We're excited about this new album, and it's been a long time coming. And Nick really put a lot of work in on the album this time around, and it's really above and beyond anything that we've ever done before. So it's really cool.
On February 10th, Sub Pop announced the label had signed Yahtzeen. Formed in 1986, the label gained a reputation for signing keystone Seattle grunge bands like Nirvana and Soundgarden. Its current roster includes Fleet Foxes and the Postal Service. Though the two didn't know it at the time, Wass and Gallinan had personal relationships with Sub Pop co-founder Jonathan Poneman, and those connections sparked the project that would eventually become the studio album, Glennon says.
You know, the legendary, right? Jonathan, who is co-founder of the label, who's we've been working pretty closely with, continuing on this project from the, you know, very beginning, has really, I think, been wonderful to work with and provide us with quite an opportunity. They'll always have a deep-rooted history in music history. So to have Indigenous artists in this space, even, I think, is incredible and necessary, because I don't think that I've seen too many Indigenous artists in this place.
The group worked previously under the name Indian Agent. Work on the latest album began about 3 years ago while Gallinan was carving a pole in Juneau. Beside his frequent bandmates, Wass and Calvin, the full-length album Indian Yard features a number of collaborations, including two names that might be familiar to Alaskans: Kuchung of Bumua and Portugal the Man. Wass says the collaborations help keep playing with the band fresh.
Whatever we're working on, it's like it feels different from before. I like that. I like that about working with Nick. It's never like the same thing again and again. But what we do, we're bringing in these other people, and it's like we're always evolving and changing. So
Gallinan says that normally the band would likely be planning for a tour with the release, but a global pandemic has halted most live performances and touring.
The industry has changed so much. It continually does, but, you know, all industries and all creative fields and stuff have been deeply impacted by COVID times. So, yeah, we're learning what it looks like as we go in a lot of ways.
The album is scheduled to release April 30th. The single, Close the Distance, is available to stream on a number of platforms. In Anchorage, I'm Trip Krause.
Over the weekend, Juneau City officials warned of the potential for historic avalanches, prompting a voluntary evacuation of one downtown neighborhood. Most residents stayed with relatives or friends in town, but a few spent Saturday night at Centennial Hall, where the city and the Red Cross set up an evacuation center. KTOO's Jennifer Pemberton has the story.
Heavy, wet snow, a kind of slush, was falling in Juneau on Saturday night. It's the kind of snow you can hear hitting the ground with a splash. And it's really hard to shovel. It's like lifting a couple gallons of water. It wasn't much better at the top of Mount Juneau, where the same wet concrete snow was piling up on top of this winter's very unstable snowpack. Juneau's urban avalanche forecast was for extreme danger on Saturday. That's a 5 on a scale that goes to 5. The city's emergency manager, Tom Matisse, said it was the first time he'd ever forecasted an extreme avalanche condition for Juneau. It was also the first time since 2008 that the city recommended that people in the Barrons Avenue neighborhood near downtown evacuate their homes. The Barrons Avenue avalanche path runs down Mount Juneau on the side facing Gastineau Channel near Juneau Douglas High School. It's obvious where the path is, especially in summer when you can see a distinct lack of trees. At the bottom of the path is 3 rows of houses.
I knocked on 39 doors today, a couple more on the edges of the avalanche path, but that's how many houses I knocked on and logged in my record.
I talked to Tom Matisse at the city's evacuation center on Saturday night. He said most people are staying at friends' houses or hotels.
There are several people that had motorhomes or boats and a lot of people with relatives in town. And so we wanted to make sure that we had people that had an option.
So the city teamed up with the Red Cross and opened up Centennial Hall. Only a few people registered to stay overnight, but it's busy with volunteers. One of the ballrooms is set up with about 6 white tents, each with a few cots inside, so families can stay together and spread out from other groups of people, both for privacy and COVID-19 safety. Michelle Brown is a Juneau City employee and a Red Cross volunteer.
You can see the little tent. We've got a wool blanket. We've got a fleece blanket. We've got pillows in there for folks. So we're set up to be able to help with the whole situation if it comes to that.
2 officers with Juneau Animal Control are here, too, so that people can bring their pets with them or even drop them off if they need to stay somewhere their pets can't. They have a few cat carriers and some leashes at the ready. Jordan Bales is one of the animal control officers.
What we're offering is, you know, holding people's animals for up to 10 days if need be, free of charge.
No pets are here yet, but someone stopped by earlier to say his cat had run away in the avalanche zone. They filed a lost pet report for him and are hopeful the cat will be found. The next day, the avalanche advisory was high, but no longer extreme, and there didn't end up being any slides in the Barrons Avenue area. The forecast for Sunday was for colder temperatures and less precipitation, so even though conditions were right for large avalanches, Matisse wrote in his report that, quote, "We may have dodged a bullet for the time being on the big one." For now, that top layer of new snow, called the storm slab, doesn't seem like it's going to come down. It's deep enough, though, that an avalanche would reach the houses at the bottom of the avalanche path. And underneath that storm slab is a deeper layer of snow from earlier in the year, called the persistent weak layer. If that layer slid down the hill with everything on top of it, that avalanche would go all the way past the houses and Glacier Avenue and down to Gastineau Channel. And that persistent weak layer of snow is still there. And Matisse says it's there under the snow throughout the entire region.
This year is going to be dangerous, and this year is going to be spooky, and it may not end until all the snow is gone in the spring.
On Sunday, Matisse went up the Dan Moeller Trail on Douglas Island. He said he saw what he called 30 to 100-year avalanches, meaning really big ones, the kinds that snap off branches and knock whole trees down. There's still significant danger in the backcountry and in urban areas, and there's more rain and snow in the forecast for this week. In Juneau, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
When the next Anchorage mayor takes office in July, there'll be one big issue waiting for them to tackle: pandemic recovery. Businesses have shut down or are scraping by, and many residents are struggling to hold on to housing. The Anchorage Economic Development Corporation estimated it could be years before the workforce returns to pre-pandemic levels. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George spoke to several candidates for mayor to hear about their visions for the recovery process.
Come July, several candidates for Anchorage mayor are hoping the city's COVID-19 situation will be greatly improved.
We still need to be cautious, but I am optimistic that we will be much further down the road towards a full reopening.
So that we can be focusing on you know, recovery instead of protections at that point.
That's East Anchorage Assembly member Forrest Dunbar and former South Anchorage and Girdwood Assembly member Bill Evans. Like many mayoral candidates, both Dunbar and Evans say economic growth is central to their plans to lead the city out of more than a year of a pandemic that cost many people their loved ones, jobs, and economic stability. In January, the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation reported the lowest level of local economic confidence in their survey's history. The city will have to add more than 18,000 jobs to return to pre-pandemic levels, which AEDC estimates could take years. Candidate George Martinez is a former special assistant to Mayor Berkowitz focused on economic development and youth development. He says the hole the city is in now existed long before the pandemic.
The Anchorage Economic Community Development Corporation gives us data that suggests that we've been on an economic downward spiral, losing population, losing jobs, shifting nature of work for several years now.
Each of the six candidates currently leading the race in fundraising have different ideas to pull Anchorage out of that downward spiral. Some, like Dunbar and former city manager Bill Falsey, who have been deeply involved in the city's pandemic response, say they want to build on the work the administrations and assembly have done over the past year. With more federal aid expected, Dunbar says one area he wants to improve is deploying relief money more efficiently.
I'm hoping this next round, because we already have a lot of those processes in place, we can get it into people's hands much faster.
Falsey, who also helped coordinate the city's response to the 2018 earthquake, says he wants to make sure the city communicates better about response measures to avoid some of the confusion and backlash.
It's not as much about just communicating what the decision is, but why you're doing it and what the alternative options that were considered were. And that's not only for legitimacy and for confidence, but also for error checking. So if something has been missed, that gets surfaced.
Other candidates are hoping to veer further from the current pandemic response. Evans says public health restrictions should be reevaluated.
Make sure they're narrowly tailored to both meet the public health needs, but also allow businesses to survive and jobs to last. And people to remain in a position where they can support their families.
Martinez says there hasn't been enough focus on addressing economic, health, and education equity gaps during the pandemic.
To me, the priority is there. You stop the bottom from falling out on people who need that help early on. You focus your education resources, you focus the outreach resources on where those equity gaps are.
Candidate Mike Robbins, an Anchorage businessman, did not respond to multiple requests for an interview for this story. He has largely opposed the assembly's pandemic response and says he has a plan to reopen businesses. Former Air Force and commercial pilot Dave Bronson declined a phone interview. He has also advocated for rolling back restrictions and says he plans to establish new tax incentives to increase business development. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Doubling up on fish board meetings gets pushback from fishermen. It's the last day to comment. More after this.
Have fish in the freezer? Have it on the table in minutes with Azmi's new Cook It Frozen and hundreds of other recipes at wildalaskaseafood.com.
Today, March 2nd, is the final day to comment on how the Board of Fisheries can best conduct a COVID-toppled meeting schedule. The board will meet on March 8th to decide when, where, and how to fit in a double slate for two Alaska regions. The board would normally be wrapping up a roster that included 275 proposals for Southeast, Prince William Sound, and statewide shellfish this month. It's being proposed to bump those meetings to next winter or mix them in with an already scheduled lineup for other regions this fall. Glenn Haight is board's director.
We currently have the work session in October, and then that's followed immediately by the Pacific Cod meeting, which is for Alaska Peninsula, Aleutian Islands, Bering Sea, and Chinook. Those are currently slated for October, and then we have Bristol Bay that will happen in December. So we already have some scheduled for this fall. It's possible you could put in a Prince William Sound meeting or a Southeast meeting, say, in November, and then continue on into January with some of the other ones.
Meanwhile, United Fishermen of Alaska has come out against the double up, saying it creates a huge inequity between regions and weakens the strong public process the board is known for. UFA also claims it puts too much demand on advisory committees and makes it impossible for Fish and Game staff to adequately prepare and participate. UFA, which represents over 35 Alaska and Seattle-based fishing groups, is asking that the Fish Board push all the meetings back 1 year until it's safe to meet in person. UFA encourages fishermen to submit comments and select the March 8, 2021 sunset provisions and future meeting dates meeting option. Comments are due by midnight tonight, March 2nd. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon. It is Tuesday, the 2nd of March, 2021. Sunrise this morning was at 8 a.m. and will set tonight at 6:45 a.m. Gives us a total amount of 10 hours and 45 minutes of daylight, which is a 4-minute and 59-second gain from yesterday. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:57 a.m. And the record high was 50 degrees in 1996, and we had a record low of 2 degrees in 1994. It's 37 degrees in Kodiak currently, west winds at 9 miles per hour. This afternoon, scattered snow showers, mostly sunny with a high near 37 degrees, northwest winds around 5 miles per hour with a 40% chance of precipitation. And tonight, isolated snow showers, partly cloudy with a low around 27 degrees, northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour, and gusts as high as 20. Tomorrow looks like it's going to be mostly sunny with a high near 33 degrees and northwest winds 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts as high as 25. In Homer, it's 26 degrees and mostly cloudy with northeast winds at 10 miles per hour. And in Anchorage, it's mostly cloudy and 13 degrees with north winds at 6 miles per hour. The synopsis for the North Gulf Coast and Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet: a 980 millibar low, 120 nautical miles east of Cordova, moves inland by this afternoon. Several troughs move over the Gulf through Thursday afternoon. For Chiniac Bay today, variable winds less than 10 knots, becoming northwest 10 knots in the afternoon, seas 2 feet. And tonight through Wednesday night, northwest winds 20 knots, seas 3 feet. For Marmot Bay today, west winds 10 knots, seas 2 feet. And tonight, north winds 15 knots, seas 2 feet. And for the Shelcoff Strait, small craft advisory Wednesday. Today, southwest winds 20 knots, becoming north 20 in the afternoon, seas 5 feet. And tonight, northeast winds 20 knots, seas 5 feet, subsiding to 3 feet after midnight. For the Kodiak District tides, we'll have a high tide this afternoon at 4:05 p.m. of 8.46 feet, and a low following that at 10:05 p.m. of negative 0.11 feet. And for the west side, we'll have a high at 4:34 p.m. of 15.89 feet, and a low following that at 10:45 p.m. of negative 0.98 feet. And it looks like a couple community announcements here. The Kodiak Arts Council is thrilled to offer a free program for young artists age 4 through 8 called Cabin Fever Crafting. All you have to do is drop by the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium Monday through Friday, 10 to 4 p.m. And the kit comes with everything, including how to make it. So if you want to access the video that accompanies the craft, go to www.kodiakarts.org and enjoy.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day. Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.